Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, I have a special guest. His name is Jim Corey, and he has a magazine called Diversity Rules, and he'll be starting his own radio show, which you can be looking for 2 weeks from Wednesday. It's going to be Diversity Rules on Air. And tonight we're going to talk to him about his background and about his magazine. And before we begin, I just wanted to announce the next couple of shows that are coming up. We have some fabulous shows. Next Thursday, January 16th, there's going to be a powerhouse show with a very brave man by the name of Jim, who is a recovering drug addict, recovering alcoholic. He almost died from those addictions, and he's a recovering sex addict. So you can look for that show next Thursday at 3:30 p.m. And then a week from tonight, the 17th, I'm going to have on a special guest, Yvonne Perry, and she is owner of Writers in the Sky, and she'll discuss a background that includes religious abuse, and she'll discuss all kinds of things, including communication with loved ones on the other side and the meaning of suicide. So please tune in for those shows, and if for some reason you can't tune in live, you can always find them on blogtalkradio.com/author David Clark in the archives or on Spiritually Raw Broadcasting Network. So let me introduce Jim by reading his biography. Jim Corey is the editor, publisher of Diversity Rules magazine, which is an alternative-focused publication primarily dealing with the queer community's concerns and issues, along with issues of diversity generally. He is an activist who is not afraid to ruffle some feathers, and his main objective is to get people to think and think for themselves. He espouses Aristotle's mantra, "It is the mark of an educated mind to entertain a thought without accepting it." Jim does not force his views on others, but just puts them out there for folks to think about and discard if they wish. And that's what I do on this show, too. It's all a matter of planting seeds, food for thought, and we don't need to necessarily agree. It's a matter of trying to see where another person is coming from and see if it fits. If it doesn't fit, so be it. But there's always common ground that we can find with anyone if only we open our minds and search for it. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my guest, Jim Corey. Jim, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you for inviting me. It's great being here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. It's been a pleasure. It's been great
to
talk with you beforehand.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Well, I think we're going to have a great show. You're a very dynamic person, very motivated individual who has a very interesting magazine, and we'll want to talk about that and about your background. I would like to ask you just to tell me a little bit about what your early life was like.
My early life, it was, you know, I had a good childhood. I had no major issues growing up, my folks didn't fight, or at least they didn't fight in front of us. You know, my brothers, I had two brothers and myself. But I knew, I grew up knowing I was different. So there's always that subliminal, hidden feeling that I had that I couldn't really put my fingers on. You know, it was something that really focused on too much, but it didn't really impact my childhood. Other than, you know, I felt like a loner sometimes, and I felt reclusive, and you know, I had a lot of friends, but I didn't have a lot of friends. So my early life, all in all, was a good experience, but I had that hidden function going in the background, you know, always with that nagging feeling that something was different about me as a young child even.
Well, I had that experience too, and I think in talking with other gay people that most of us have had that experience, whether or not we could identify that concern was connected to sexuality at such an early age.
Yeah, you don't really know what it is because you don't know what sex is and gay and straight and all that, but you just know something's not right. Or not,
yeah,
right. I mean, not,
yeah,
not like
tough.
Other kids. Yeah.
Right, right. And I don't know how you felt about it, but I just wanted to be like the other kids. I wanted to be so-called normal, and that theme haunted me into my early adult years because I didn't want to be gay when I found out what gay meant. I couldn't relate to what I'd heard about other gay people, and it didn't seem like me, and I wanted to have the white picket fence and a wife and two
yep.
kids and a dog and a cat and live in suburbia. Yeah, so, you know,
totally agree.
That wasn't
that's
meant to
exactly
be for
how
me.
I felt.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's tough. It's a real challenge. And I think even today it's challenging, but times have changed, thank God.
I agree. I think it's a lot easier for young kids now, depending on what part of the country you're in, obviously, but I think generally for a young child feeling what we felt as a child, I think it might be a little easier because there's so much out there. There's the internet, and kids are on the internet, and they can do their own investigation without people knowing what they're looking at. So, and it's more exciting.
Well, I think one of the things that...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I just was going to say, I think one of the things that can make it difficult for people even today is the kind of religious atmosphere that they're brought up in, because
sure.
there are a lot of religious attitudes that are anti-gay. And on that note, I just would like to ask you what kind of religion was practiced in your home and if you were able to develop a sense of spirituality as a child.
Well, I was born and raised a Catholic. I was brought up with that belief in Jesus, you know, the life hereafter. You know, I was baptized, I was confirmed, and had my first communion and all that stuff. But, you know, a lot of what I was being taught, I didn't really believe it. I believed it, but I didn't, you know, so that was what my sense of spirituality was. I always had faith ever since a little kid into my, you know, my current age. I always had a faith in the life after. I always had faith and trust in something greater than me. But I really wasn't sure, even as a younger child, if the Catholic thing was what it was all about, you know. But I was brought up a good Catholic. I did all the Catholic things. I went to church every Sunday. Did the Holy Days of Obligation, did First Communion, and, you know, so that was what my upbringing was. And, you know, as the older
Where do you
I got,
think your faith came from?
You know, my parents, my grandparents. I was brought up in an Italian home. My grandmother lived with us. So that was a function of that. That was inbred in, not inbred in us, but it was ingrained in us that there you know, we need to believe in something. So, you know, in that respect, my folks did a great job, you know, bringing this up.
Oh, that's wonderful.
In some sort of faith in something. So, but
did
alas,
you develop
that changed
any conflicts?
The older I got.
Yeah. I wondered if you developed any conflicts due to religion and some of the messages that you might have heard that spoke against homosexuality.
Well, you know, with being Catholic, there was that dogma fed to you. You know, I didn't like a lot of the dogma. The older I got, the more guilt I had because I was fast coming to the realization that I was gay. And, you know, I kept going to Mass and I'd hear priests talk about homosexuality being a sin and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when I got to the point where I came out, or I came out to myself, that was really the turning point with my faith, is when I accepted myself but not outwardly expressed my sexuality. Then I started to retreat from a lot of that dogma. I started to really disagree with a lot of what was being said, and I got really tired of this love the sinner, not the sin kind of crap. You know, I just got tired of that.
Yeah.
So eventually, that rejection, I just totally rejected my faith at a certain point in my life and had nothing.
What age were
you
in touch with your sexuality?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
when, that. Oh, that's okay. This is the problem with doing internet radio, is that we can't see each other. I just wondered when you became aware that you might be gay.
I knew pretty much when I got to junior high school that something was different. You know, grade school, it was like this feeling. But, you know, puberty hits and you start getting all those hormonal urges and in junior high school, 7th and 8th grade, and I was becoming fast apparent to me that I did not like the girls. You know, I tried to suppress that. You know, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't repress that feeling that I was looking at the guys before I was looking at the girls. So that's sort of when I started to become aware of my sexuality and what I was becoming. And the guilt just got worse and worse. And then, you know, you start fabricating your life. And that's really, I'd have to say, when I seriously began to fabricate this facade that I cocooned myself around in, you know, in grade school.
Now, you grew up in a rural part of
school.
New York State. I was saying you grew up in a rural part of New York State, and you described it as being more provincial. When did you come out, and how did your folks deal with the news?
Well, I actually came out in 1997, and what really induced me, which is it's sort of funny when I think about it now, I was at a conference for work, and people were trying to set me up with this woman, this fellow person that was at this meeting, and I'm like, no, I'm really tired of this. I'm really tired of trying, you know, these people, they should know, and I shouldn't have to tell them I'm gay, but, you know, that was my inducement. I went home. 2 weeks later, I had planned the trip to go to Montreal, so I had all these books. You know, this is sort of a cop-out way to do it, but my mom would watch my cats when I went away. So I went to Montreal, and I strategically left these books around the house where she could obviously see them, you know. And so I got back from Montreal, and I went down to talk to them and tell them I got home. And, you know, it was like this big elephant in the room. She wanted to say something, and I wanted to say something. So I finally broke the ice. I said, I guess you saw the books, right? And she's like, yeah. And she's like, well, you know, why don't you just continue on with don't ask, don't tell? And I said, well, that's the issue. I don't want to continue with that. You know, so that was my turning point in 1997. That's when I came out publicly, and I started to come out to various close friends of mine and people at work and that I could trust. And that's when my evolution as a gay man started in 1997. At a young age,
I'm curious, what kinds of books did you leave for your mother?
I can't remember the titles, but they were just basically books on homosexuality, how to tell close friends and family that you're gay. That was one of the titles, how to tell your friends and family you're gay. So, you know, you two and two together. My mother was a smart person. She sort of realized what was going on. Yeah.
But I think you'd have to be pretty dense not to pick up on a book that says, how do you tell your friends and family?
Yeah, and you know, my father was a little...
challenges?
I just wondered
what your unique challenges have been with being gay.
Well, in terms of unique challenges, I guess they're not so much unique. You know, my challenges were probably those that were experienced by many others. You know, fear, rejection, guilt. But one thing that probably was a little more pronounced with me was, you know, sex was underground with me. This is before I came out to everybody. It was very clandestine. It was seedy. You know, I needed to satisfy these urges, but I couldn't in an outward way. And that was one thing that was a big challenge for me. So I'm a very sexual person now and always have been. And to not be able to express myself the way I wanted, it frustrated me quite a bit, you know. So
any idea how you wanted to express it?
In terms of how I did or how I wanted to?
No. Did you have any sense on how you wanted to express it, even when you realized that you weren't expressing it in a way that
might have been? Well, you know, I was frustrated because I was not able to be myself, and people were always like, you know, you got to grow up, you got to get married. When you getting married, and you know that it was that whole. God, I got to tell them somehow, you know, that I don't like that kind of sex. So clearly, you know, there was this wall and you couldn't go beyond it. And, you know, yeah, that was challenging for me.
Yeah. Have you ever experienced depression or abuse?
No. I would say... not really, other than the abuse I took in gym class, because I hated gym class. That was about it in terms of the abuse. You know, but...
Yeah, well, that seems to be a common thread for a lot of gay men.
Yeah, I was not athletically inclined.
That was the case for me.
Tested going to gym class, just like, oh, I hate being here. The favorite part of gym class was shower time. You know, I mean, I probably like every other gay guy. It was the end of gym class shower time. Isn't that bad?
Uh-huh.
That's so bad to say, but it's true.
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, you're telling it like it is, so what's the harm?
That's what I'm all about.
Well, you may have alluded to this before, but how did you deal with your sexuality during the sexual revolution?
Well, I was a teenager in the 70s, so I wasn't out, but I knew I was different. So I was repressing my sexuality, you know, during a time when folks were out there experimenting, and I was going to parties, and people were, you know, taking their girlfriends wherever and doing the deed, and... And, you know, you'd be at parties and you'd hear the stories about people doing this stuff. And me, I'm just sitting there. I'm like, I don't have any stories. I don't like women. I don't like doing that. And so I felt very repressed and very alone that way because I couldn't really tell people what I really wanted to do. I would have to say... in terms of the revolution, I didn't participate in it in the way other people did. Yeah.
Well, I can relate to a lot of what you were saying. It was a challenge for me to dealing with my sexuality early on, and perhaps in different ways. As I have put it out there before on the show, I'm a recovering sex addict, and I was I really bought into the having sex with whoever back in the late 70s and early 80s when I was coming out, and it was almost a badge of honor then to be promiscuous, and I didn't view it that way. I once had somebody call me a whore, and I thought, my God, I'm not a whore. You know, I'm
like
not doing
sex.
Anything different than what anybody else is doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a sense, the behavior was just that. I just didn't realize it, and I didn't realize that there might have been a more appropriate and healthy way to express my sexuality, and it took me a long time to find my way to that.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I'm not sure. I would have to say I probably had a form of sexual addiction in college and into the 90s. Because I was in my 20s and my 30s exploring things, and I wanted to explore things, but I couldn't explore them the way everybody else was. So I did. I found venues that were clandestine, that were, you know, seedy and shady and, you know, rest areas, parks, and all the whole gamut of things. And it was, you know, it was what it was. And I look back on it now and I'm like, I could have really gotten into a lot of trouble.
I've been in all those places, been there, done that. And there was a part of me, even at the time, that I was thinking, what's wrong with this? Everybody else is doing it. I felt guilty because that was the way homosexuals were negatively portrayed, the promiscuous sex and sex in public places. And I was doing it, you know, and yet I wanted to be proud. And how could I be proud about that kind of behavior?
Yeah, and exactly. I mean, I'd be at these places, and I'd be working up to get off, and I'd get off, and then I'd get this rush of guilt. Oh my God, I'm never going to do this again. This is horrible. I'm not going to do this again. Then I'd go home. Then the next night, I'd be out again. I'm like, all right, that was oh my God. Like it was a horrible cycle. It really was.
Well, it's a vicious cycle, and I think for me, the guilt turned into shame, and shame is what drove the cycle for me, because I would want to medicate the awful feelings. And how would I do that? I'd do that through something that made me feel good, and what made me feel good was having sex.
Yeah.
And then I'd go out and do the same things
coping
in the same kinds of places.
Yeah, and another coping mechanism with me, like in college, I would just get so drunk. I wasn't an alcoholic, but I would just party. I'd smoke weed, I'd drink, and then that would be my excuse why I didn't pick anybody up and go have sex. You know, I was too drunk, you know. And that was the routine every weekend. So, and that's what I relied on. That
right.
That was my crutch, you know.
Well, what were the lessons that you learned from that?
That I hated denying myself. I hated myself for doing it, and basically I had made a vow to myself that I would work to change it. You know, it took a long time to change that mindset, but with every step of my evolution forward of, you know, coming out, I did deal with that. So I did change it, and that was the good part of it. But I would have to say that was the main thing. I hated myself, and I just vowed that I was going to change this, and I didn't want to continue the way it was, continuing. Yeah.
When and how did you become a gay activist, Jim?
Well, I would say this has been, an evolution for me. Beginning in my 20s, when I first came out to myself, I would start to take more adamant stances. You know, if somebody said something about gay people, I'd pipe up. I really wouldn't get in their face about it, but I wouldn't let the comment go. So, and then when I came out in 1997, when I came out publicly, I would start to get more vocal and more adamant about things and, you know, taking a more active role publicly in gay issues. I would say it was just an evolution. So, you know, it's a progression of my outness determined how out I would be and how vocal I would be with my activism.
And how did your activism play out?
To the point where I'm at today, I love being an activist. It's, you know, I feel like I'm doing my part to change things. I've been accused of being too in your face or too aggressive, you know, and I've never been one to buy into the politically correct gay movement, you know, where you don't offend people and you step on eggshells. You don't step on eggshells. I'm the kind of person that just gets right out there, says what needs to be said, and that's my brand of activism, you know. I hate the apathy, yeah. And I hate this mentality that someone else will do it, and that's what drives me nuts when people tell me that I'm too in your face and too aggressive and too vocal. And like Martin Luther King would disagree with you, and Malcolm X would disagree
there
with
you,
and all the actors, you know, Harvey Milk would disagree with you about. I figure I'm in good company, so.
I'm not even sure what in your face means. You know,
well,
if you're being true to yourself.
Exactly.
You know, anybody.
I was being brash and abrasive, but I'm like, you know, I'm just being me. You can't deal with me, then that's your problem.
Right. Well, I always think of the old line, to thine own self be true. And for anybody to deny somebody else's right to express who they really are, I think they need to take a good look at themselves and what their own values are and perhaps what their own hidden agendas or their own secrets that they may keep closed in their own closets.
I think it's a lot of it has to do with people wanting maybe to be more aggressive, and it's like a coping mechanism for them to accuse somebody else of being too open about things when they want to inside themselves be the same way, you know?
Mm.
I don't know. It's just an observation.
What have been some of your frustrations? What have been some of your frustrations with being an activist?
Yeah, I just touched on that. The apathy, I try to...
Mm.
I like to mobilize people and get... It's very hard to do that, and when people don't respond in the way I want them to, and get animated and get excited, my passion doesn't carry through to other people, which that's one frustration I have. And that's just you.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I it could have something to do with. Like I said, not wanting to be out in front, being insecure about themselves, just leaving it to other people. I mean, I think what a lot of people do, they pay their $50 to the Human Rights Campaign or other similar group, and they defer their personal responsibility to these politically correct organizations that really I don't think are addressing our needs. They're addressing our needs. They have the money. They have the lobbying, which is great. I miss the Harvey Milk mentality. I think I would love to see people get out into the streets, you know, take their shirts off, you know, whatever. You know, I think that is sort of what we need. And my frustration lies with that lack of desire to get into the streets and do a little protesting and just being more vocal about things.
For some of the younger people that may not know who Harvey Milk is, would you educate us?
Harvey Milk was the a city council member in San Francisco who was the first elected gay person to a local office like that, and he mobilized San Francisco into, you know, he would organize protests and hard enough with the icon of California in the 70s, and he was murdered in City Hall along with Mayor Moscone in City Hall. So he sort of became he became the icon of, I think he's an icon, and I respect the man so much, and I would have loved to have talked to him. I think I manifest milk in a lot of ways.
Well, that's great. What a wonderful thing to aspire to and to achieve. For those who don't know, there's a wonderful film called The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, and I would recommend that to any young gay person that wants to find something that is affirming, that will speak to them about the joy of being gay and what it's like to feel proud of yourself.
Exactly. And he embodied that. I mean, he really, I respected the guy so much. He just got out there and mobilized people and had protests, and he wasn't afraid of who he was. And I respect that a lot, when somebody can actually hold their head up high and stand by their beliefs and do what they want and what's in their heart.
Right. What have been some of your most memorable moments as being an activist?
Well, I would have to say, you know, when people come up to me and they thank me for being who I am, or when I get an email from somebody saying the same thing, that's gratifying to me, because a lot of times I feel like I'm banging my head against the wall and I'm not hitting people and not getting the message out. And I get frustrated when I don't get feedback, because I'm all about feedback. I like feedback. And if I don't get it, I get frustrated. So when I get these little personal notes of thanks and gratitude and, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, I aspire to be, you know, I aspire to do what you're doing, that is very memorable, and that's very gratifying for me. And, you know, being called by the local paper now. Huh? Yeah.
I said, that's
and,
great.
You know, the local newspaper will call me. I'm considered the local gay activist in Oneonta now, so I'm always the first one that calls and want a reaction to something. So.
Now, how has being an activist and a role model impacted on how you live and interact with other people?
Many people, I think they feel like they have to act differently when they're a role model. You know, they have to put on an air or a facade of, you know, this righteous whatever kind of person. But I've always believed that being a role model means to just be the best person you can be, being true to yourself. And that may conflict with other people's morals and ethics and how they perceive things. But I don't sugarcoat things. And I say what I say, I do what I do. And I think that is being a good role model, just living your life and being true to yourself. And the quote that you recited, I love that quote. It's the mark of an educated mind.
It's a marvelous quote.
Without accepting it. And you just think. I want to get people to think and think for themselves. So I think that's what being a role model is to get people to think. They may not agree with you. Obviously, you're going to have disagreements, but I think that to me is how I want to be perceived as a role model, somebody who isn't afraid to say what they want to say and ruffle feathers, like you said at the beginning.
Did you study the philosophers when you were in school?
No, not really. I got an F in philosophy in college. I just happened to... It was like, oh, my God. No, a friend of mine turned me on to that quote, and I'm like, I loved it ever since I heard it. Yeah. Because it's true. you know.
Well, tell us about Diversity Rules magazine. Why did you start it?
Yeah, with Diversity Rules, I started this back in 2006. I looked at my area of New York State, and I said, you know, there's really not anything here to educate and mobilize or, you know, people to come around. And it's like, yeah, get that magazine. So I started it as a more local thing, like a three-county area. And then before I knew it, you know, I was increasing copies and going further outside of my local area to the point where I eventually was going all over New York State. I was printing like 10,000 copies of the thing. It was a bi-monthly thing, not like today, which is it's a monthly now. But it was going along. It was cool. People were liking it. It was a free model distribution. You know, it was being funded by advertisers and things like that. And then the economy tanked, and so did everything in terms of money. And so then I stopped publishing it for about a year, digital, for 2 years. And then I brought it back into print on a subscription-only basis in March of 2013. So it's coming up on a year that I've returned to print. It's a full-color glossy. People like it. I think they like it. People tell me they like it. So I need more subscriptions and advertisers, and that would really prove to me that they liked it. But, yeah, it's my passion.
Well,
it's my baby. And all the while I wasn't printing it, I never lost the thought that I was going to come back and bring it back. You know, I never lost sight of the fact that I was going to come back to print.
Is it available online?
Yeah, it's in digital format. If you go to my website, diversityrulesmagazine.com, you can access the iFolds version, which is like the little flip book version. And then people can get it on their iPads and iPods and on their Android devices now. So it's a lot of options to access it. And then obviously, like I said, there's the print copy as well.
Well, why don't we put out the website again, Jim, for people that may not have had a chance to copy it down. So everybody
sure.
Get out your pens and pieces of paper now, and Jim will give the website address.
It is www.diversityrulesmagazine.com. Or if you do a Google
and if somebody
search,
wants
Diversity
to
Rules, you'll get it.
Great. And if somebody wants to get a print copy, what's the best way for them to go about that?
They can order it through PayPal. There's a subscription link on my website, and there's a PayPal button. And then there's a mail-in subscription form that they can use, too, if they don't want to use PayPal. All the options are right on the subscription page on the website.
How much is the magazine?
I am running a special right now for the month of January. It's normally $14.95 a year for 12 issues, but I'm doing a $10.95 special for the month of January. So this is the time to get it.
Boy, that's a bargain.
It's still a good deal.
I think that you are you're underselling yourself, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, most magazines go for $3 and $4.
Yeah, I kept it low because I wanted to attract people to it. You know, I sell it. So I'm probably going to have to increase the subscription price eventually, but I wanted to keep it purposely low to induce people to give it a try. And you can order single copies as well. There's a button on the subscription page to order single copies, which is $2.95.
What can people find in a typical issue?
I have a lot of different things. I have a feature interview, which I find one person that I do a main interview with. Then I have a woman who's a remarkable spiritual person. I was telling you about her earlier today, Terry Ludwig. She writes a column called Keep Up Now, based on writings of her brother who died of AIDS. And she's a remarkable person. So she's a recurring person in Diversity Rules. And I have book reviews, I have CD reviews, you know, there's a column called The Amazon Trail. It's something by Lee Lynch is her name. She's a phenomenal lesbian writer, and she, you know, she's very popular. And what else do I have? I have a column called Inquiries, where it's like somebody writes a question. It's like a Dear Abby kind of column.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a couple
what
travel articles.
What can people
articles.
Be looking for? In...
What's
Go
that?
Ahead.
Oh, no.
Oh,
I
just wondered what people
couple...
could be looking
for. Okay, I'll let you go.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to ask what people could be looking for in the upcoming issue.
Oh, in February? I have a person.
Yeah.
Her name is Barb. And you asked me. I've lost her last name. That's embarrassing here. But she is a bisexual.
It'll come to you.
It'll come to me. And, so she's a very eclectic person. I think she'll be a great interview person. I'm looking forward to having her here. She's a musician. She's done a lot of work with a lot, you know, like with Blondie and people like that. So it should be an interesting interview. And then I have a book review coming up again, and I have a new column coming. It's a gay lawyer is going to do some. A column each month about legal issues that will impact gay people. It's called The Gay Advocate. So that's a new thing coming along and forward
cool.
to. Yeah. So I try to keep the content different. Barb Morrison, I just couldn't remember her name. If she's listening, I apologize.
I knew it would come to you.
Yeah.
That happens to me all the time.
Oh, my God. It's crazy. You lose something that has been on your head all day long, and then somebody asks you what it is, and you lose it. But, yeah, February should be a great issue. I try to keep it fresh and, you know, a lot of different content. And, you know, a lot of the content appeals to a lot of different people. I mean, I even have a column called Raven's Porn Corner. I have a guy that interviews a male porn star every month. That raises brows
for
some people. Yeah. That raises brows with some
is
people.
Is that for
but
real?
I say, you know what? Our tent is big, and I'm not
it
a vanilla
is.
Publication. I never had the intent to be a vanilla publication, so I try to reach all parts of our community. I mean, it's not porn. I
now,
mean,
why
I
did
have
you
pictures of,
why did you pick the name Diversity Rules?
I like the cliche part of it. You know, like Diversity Rules. You know. It is the way it is, you know. I don't know, I just liked it. And when I first started it, I would do Diversity Rules! ! But I dropped the ! Point, and now it's just Diversity Rules Magazine.
Well, I announced that you're going to be starting a radio show, and I know that it's in the early stages of development for you, but I wondered if you had any ideas about the show that you would like to share with listeners.
Well, what I'm going to do, I'm going to use this as a vehicle to promote, my feature interview, my feature interviewee. I want to try to get the feature interviewee on a show during the course of the month, and then I want to highlight some of my recurring writers that are in the magazine, and I have a person that wrote a book that's going to be who wants to come on and promote his book, and he was a past cover feature a few months ago. So yeah, I envision this as just being another extension of the voice of the gay community and reaching people that I may not reach in the print publication or on the iPads and the iPods and the Android devices. So a lot of people like radio and they listen, you know.
They do. And
yeah.
If anybody wanted to sponsor you or appear in an ad on your show, what would be the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I would say just go to my magazine website and use the email that is there info@diversityrulesmagazine.com. And I would love that
okay.
if I got people that wanted to advertise and be sponsors.
I would think that there would be a lot of people out there, and it's just a matter of getting a little bit of exposure. You know, you'll get your show up and running, and then that will generate interest.
I've put teasers out there on Facebook.
Good. Use that social media. That's great.
It is good.
Now, have you had any episodes of discrimination against you because of the magazine?
Yeah. Actually, I did. I had one major episode. I was sitting here checking my email one day, and in the subject line it said cease and desist. And I'm like, okay, that's spam. And I almost deleted it, but I didn't. And I opened it up, and somebody had threatened my life. They said if I did not cease and desist publishing this trash, to use his words, that I would have to watch my back, and there were people out there watching me, and the blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I froze. I froze.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, my God, somebody's threatening my life. It was horrible.
Yeah.
So I printed out the email and took it right up to the police station. I'm like, look at this, you know? And they're like, yeah, this is pretty bad. So they ended up tracing the person. They didn't get the person, unfortunately, but they traced it to where they sent it. And it was at a cyber cafe at a local hospital. And so he was a smart homophobe. Mm. He created the account there, sent the email from the account, and never checked the account from another ISP, which we were hoping, you know. So nothing ever came of it, but that I had an issue all planned, too, when that happened. And I just trashed that issue, and I said, this guy is trying to scare me into not doing this. So I took that whole issue and made an issue of about homophobia and hate, and I published the letter verbatim, and I just, like, publicized it. The Daily Star here locally printed the whole letter, and whoever this homophobe was out there, his hopes were dashed when it didn't have the impact that he thought it was going to have. Or she. It could have been a she, for all I know. But
well,
that's a
very interesting
episode topic. Yeah.
What do you think is at the root of homophobia, and what do you think about people that are the most vocal homophobes?
Well, I think a lot of homophobia is rooted in fear and a misunderstanding and not wanting to find out about people that are different. And I think a lot of cases, your extreme homophobia is grounded in people that are gay themselves, that are overcompensating for their sexuality, which is an unfortunate
mm-hmm.
thing. I did that too. When I was in the depths of my closet, I pretended I was a little GOP-er, conservo-Nazi. It was horrible. I hated it. Oh, my God. So I can understand why somebody would do it, but I dropped that facade really fast. But I think it has a lot to do with one's own fear of their own sexuality and fear of not wanting to understand and come to grips with people that are different and not wanting to embrace diversity. Because America is about diversity. It's getting more diverse every day. And these people that can't accept diversity are going to be on the losing side of history, unfortunately. Or fortunately.
Right. Well, I did the same thing. I was very fearful of my own sexuality,
yeah.
fearful that anybody would discover me, and I was very vocal back during the days of Anita Bryant. I advocated for her and what
really?
Her campaign was.
Yeah. Well,
absolutely.
I was a big Ronnie Reagan fan, Mr. Conservative, you know, so I can understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I hated
well,
Anita
what
Bryant.
Would you say to... What would you say to somebody that is suffering from homophobia due to their own fear of their own sexuality? What words of encouragement might you give to them?
I have actually run into this, and you know, you got to tread on, you got to tread water with people like that. I try to get them to comprehend a person's sexuality in a generic way, but not point out the fact that I think they may be gay. Because once you do that, you,
right.
you just make them go deeper inside themselves, you know? So I try to put things
right,
in
right.
a third person like that. Can you imagine somebody doing XYZ and, you know, throwing out hypothetical instances? And you can only hope that something hits them and makes them, like, click and say, yeah, geez, I got to stop doing this. But,
yeah.
You know, hate is hate.
Where do you see yourself going with the magazine, Jen?
Huh?
Where do you see yourself going with the magazine and your advocacy efforts over the next few years?
Well, I want to expand the magazine into other areas. Right now it's a general content, sort of like an out-advocate kind of magazine. But I would envision doing local versions of diversity rules in select areas of the country, like the New York City edition, the San Francisco edition, you know, or taking the generic version and keeping the columnists that come in down on a monthly basis and then leaving the rest of the content up to a local community to fill. You know, so I see I have
Oh, that would be great.
Plans. Yeah, so... But
getting back to people who may feel insecure about their sexuality, what's the best advice that you could give to somebody who's coming out or thinking about coming out?
I would say, and this is what I have told people, I said, you just need to be yourself. You need to, you know, do what your gut tells you to do. You can't feel guilty. There's nothing wrong with you. You know, you just have to understand it was the way you were born. And to find somebody close to them to confide in. Because I know when I came out, I had a couple people that I really bounced things off of, and that was very helpful to me, to have a person or two close to me that, you know, that would encourage me and goad me on to do more. But, you know, I just try to tell them the more you come out, the easier it gets. Yeah.
Right, right.
But
that's been my experience,
too. There's
nothing
wrong with them. I try to tell people, I said, you know, you just have to ignore these people that think there's something wrong with you. Because you were born that way, and there's nothing you can do to change it.
Let's talk for a few minutes about spirituality and especially about gay spirituality, which I think is very important for folks that have felt religiously abused. What is your current stance on spirituality and what it means to you in your life? And can you see anything unique about?
Yeah. Like I intimated before, I've basically rejected my upbringing, the Catholic thing, the Jesus thing. I just don't believe in the Jesus thing. I think, you know, I respect people that believe in this omnipotent person that was born of a virgin in the middle of a desert and whatever. You know, I just don't buy into it. I don't buy into the Son of God thing anymore. I just believe that we're all spiritual people. I believe we all have souls that manifest in different ways many times during the course of an eternity. And I think we all cross over once we leave. I believe our bodies are, you know, our souls are just an entity of energy that leaves our body and goes somewhere else. And I don't think there's a heaven or hell. I just think we leave our physical body and we do continue on in other manifestations. Because I've done a lot of self-exploration. You know, I've talked to spiritualists, and I've had an Akashic reading done, which verifies to me that I've existed before, and I just think that we all have different versions of ourselves through time. But, yeah, I don't believe in the book. You know, the Bible is a great book. It's a resource. It belongs on a shelf in a library, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, more appropriately probably in a fiction section, but that's where I'm at with my spirituality. Yeah.
Well, you're going to have some people that are going to want to crucify you for that statement about where the Bible
belongs.
Oh,
I'm sure. I'm sure.
Yeah.
They have already, well, but, you know, like I said, good old Aristotle. Yeah.
The one thing that I've come to embrace is that Jesus is not the Son of God, and I don't think he ever intended to put that out there because I believe he was a very humble man. I think that he was telling us that we all have the potential to be the Son of God and that we're all God's children and that nobody's any better or worse than anybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, the life he led, as it's told in the Gospels, talks about how he reached out to the outcasts and affirmed them that they were worthy. And I think amongst gay people who don't feel worthy, we need role models like that, and that Jesus can be looked at as a role model or a hero.
Yeah.
And, of course, there are a lot of heroes in this world, and there are have been a lot of illuminated people such as Jesus.
Yeah.
That's what I've garnered from my spiritual research.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, I don't deny the fact
you know, gay
that
people need
been.
To be affirmed.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't deny that there might have been a person named Jesus who impacted the world in a significant way, you know, but I think these man-made tales have been fabricated around this person that may have had this influence in a certain time of humanity.
What would you say about any gays who are struggling with faith in a power greater than themselves?
Faith is a, you know, it's a very elusive thing for anybody, gay, straight, or whatever. I think if it weren't for faith, I wouldn't be here today. I mean, I've always had a faith in myself, and I think being gay, you have to have an extra degree of faith to get you through all the negativity and all the bad things that are said about you. You know, so I... however you have to do it, I would encourage any gay person to just be faithful in themselves, just be thankful and grateful that they are who they are, and just believe in themselves and have faith that they're going to change and become a better person.
Would that be your vision for gay people?
Yeah. I full equality, equal rights, no differences in people, and, you know, ultimately I'd love to see no gay pride events, because once we don't need a gay pride event, that means we're all on a level playing field, but I'm not sure if that's going to happen. It hasn't happened for black people yet, so I think we're going to be a long way off before people fully accept us beyond, you know, who we are.
Right. Well, I just have one closing question, because we're coming toward the end of the hour. Do you have a particular vision for all people?
Yeah, I mean, I
you,
would
your
love
magazine
to
is
it.
Diversity Rules.
Yeah.
And we are all unique reflections of a human experience.
Exactly.
So I wondered what thoughts you might have about that.
Yeah, I mean, diversity is not just gay. It's diversity, and I what I envision is that we all can live together and accept one another for who we are. You know, I want to see us all respecting each other's diversity and just live your own life. Let bygones be bygones and just live your own life and leave other people alone and not be judgmental. So that's really where I would love to see our society go and just have everyone respect everyone else for who they are and not make judgments against them.
Well, I hope that will come to pass. And, Jim, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, this has been great. That was a fast hour.
It goes fast. We'll have to have you on again sometime.
Yeah, definitely.
So
totally
for now,
we're
– oh, well, I've enjoyed it too. And so now we come to a close once again. Let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.